Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 85. This week, we're talking to our buddy from Tactical Approach Outdoors, Austin Stone. We got into some summer trail camera stuff for locating early season bucks. We got into how much intel from the summer you can actually put into practice when it comes to the fall, and a whole lot of other stuff. He's coming off a big weekend in Kentucky of scouting on his way to his Whitetail Slam that he's hoping to accomplish this fall. So we're going to get into all of that stuff. But first, we really appreciate you guys if you support the podcast. We appreciate you tuning in anyway. But if you want to, if you enjoy it, go ahead and support us. And you can do that a few different ways. One way is to go check out our partners at GrandpaRayOutdoors.com. Grandpa Ray Outdoors specializes in providing the best nutrition for whitetail deer on your property, starting with the soil. They've got a full line of high-quality food plot seed and plant foods with over 14 different food plot blends to choose from. You're not going to have any trouble finding what you're looking for, whether that be fall and spring blends, corn and beans, switchgrass, liquid fertilizer, soil test kits, you name it. When it comes to food plots, they've got it. Now, they were started in 2015, but John up there has been in the business since 1991. They're not just about selling their products. They'll answer any questions you have about what blends would be best for your specific property. That way you can achieve the best results possible. They're not about a fancy label or package either. They're about good quality seed and taking care of their clients. Like us, John and his team don't believe in a cookie cutter approach to wildlife nutrition, so they're going to treat you and your situation individually. We've used their products on our own properties, on client properties all over the Midwest, and the results have always been as good as advertised. That's why we started partnering with them in the first place. That's why we're going to continue to do that, continue to use their seed on our own properties and on client properties as well. So, again, you can check them out at GrandpaRayOutdoors.com. Use the discount code RHOPODCAST, that's all lowercase, no space, and you'll get 5% off your entire order there. That really helps us out with our partners, and it's going to help your deer herd out. So make sure you go do that. Also, Rodney Hawkins is our other partner for the podcast. If you're looking for your own piece of ground to manage and hunt and kind of put some of these principles that we talk about into play, then Rodney's the guy to talk to. He grew up hunting and fishing in Southern Illinois, and he's now putting that love for the outdoors into selling recreational properties as a land specialist with Midwest Farm and Land. Midwest Farm and Land isn't your average real estate company. While they do residential stuff, things of that nature, they specialize in those recreational properties. In 2022 alone, they sold over $85 million worth of ground. With agents like Rodney all over Illinois, they're really a local company with a national reach. For more info on them, anything that's available, getting your property listed, finding a property for yourself, contact Rodney directly at 618-925-3153, and he'll get you taken care of. Also, Rodney's got his own company called RG Outdoors. He's currently carrying products from Radix Blinds. He's carrying camo dust, which is an all-natural scent elimination product. He's got burner self-defense weapons, which are pretty sweet. We got to see them in studio when he came in here for the podcast. And he's also got TactiCam trail cameras. He's bringing in new stuff all the time, too. So if you're interested in anything they have to offer, you can send them a message through their Facebook page, RG Outdoors. You can email them at rgoutdoors@yahoo.com. Or again, just call Rodney directly at 618-925-3153. You can follow us on social media at Ridge Hunter Outdoors. It's Facebook and Instagram, the ones we use the most. We do have a Facebook group now, RHO Podcast Patrons. So make sure you're joining that if you listen to the podcast regularly. Even if you don't, you can still join it, and then you'll kind of see what we got coming up, stuff like that. Our website is ridgehunteroutdoors.com. If you see anything on there that you like, whether it be our scents, whether it be apparel, food plot seed, anything like that, use the discount code RHOPOD. That's all caps, no space, and you get 10% off everything in your order there. If you're listening on Apple Podcast or Spotify, just go ahead and follow us on there and leave us a review. That helps us out a lot, and it doesn't cost you anything, doesn't take much time at all, so we appreciate that. And then same thing on the YouTube channel. If that's where you listen, if you keep up with our videos there, if you want to keep up with our videos, subscribe, hit the notification bell, like and comment on anything there. So without further ado, let's get into episode number 85 with Austin Stone. This is the Ridge Hunter Outdoors Podcast. What's up, everybody? We got Austin Stone back on. We were debating, and I didn't check whether this is his third or fourth time. We think it's his fourth time back on, but like I've said before, we are definitely not scared to return guests, especially ones that we like. So we got Jeff tonight in here, me, Canyon, and then we're talking to Austin Stone from Tactical Approach Outdoors. If you guys do want to know more, kind of his backstory and stuff like that, he was on episode, it was somewhere around number 80, I believe, was the first one, or 70 was the first one you were on. And you guys can go back and listen to that, get a little background on him. Today we're going to get into some other stuff, but I know you're coming off a big weekend, Austin, so how's everything going? You're still kind of riding the high from all the card pulls?
Oh, yeah. I'm riding high ever since we located those two bucks. I mean, it was a heck of a weekend. It was funny. I was kind of joking with my brother. We kind of went into the weekend thinking that these specific locations we ended up moving to, we thought those cameras were cold. Mm-hmm. Because I had a cell cam out there and it wasn't transmitting. And I just thought that that area was cold and we were going to pull those cameras and move over to another location that we were getting pictures of bucks. I mean, not mega bucks, but they were decent deer, you know, mm-hmm. for early on in the growth period. And coming to find out, those cameras that we thought were cold are actually the hot cameras. I mean, we located a super nice 9-point, real wide, clean, typical, on this ridge system, close to some ag fields. And actually part of the property that we've never scouted before. This is a brand new part of the property for us personally. Mm-hmm. And, this other buck that we located, we got out there on day two and I had an SD card, camera out there, non-cell cam. All the other cameras around it, the cell cams I had around it were only showing young bucks and does and fawns and whatnot, nothing decent. So I was curious about what this card pull camera would show, and man, it popped off this mega 10-point. I mean, gnarly, big, heavy bases, and he's running with a wide 8-point also. Looks a little bit younger than he is, but ever since I found those, we found those bucks, we made the shift. All I've been thinking about is, okay, what's the wind going to do in that area? Mm-hmm. You know, how are they going to go about moving through those specific bedding areas and whatnot? So I am definitely still riding that high.
For sure, man. That's awesome. So when you talk about these bucks and like the sign you're finding and where they're living, what kind of gives you the idea that they're staying there most of the time? Like before you went in and set your cameras, what made you decide to set them there in the first place? And then obviously, you know, you guys went in this weekend and moved a bunch around. Why did you put them where you did after that, based on what you already knew? So first of all, we'll go to why you set them there in the first place, I guess.
Okay. The first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to find high traffic areas on multiple different portions of the property. So I think overall, by the time I got done setting cameras a little over a month ago, I had 5 different portions of the property actually covered. Mm-hmm. And high traffic areas. There was a few locations that produced for us in the past. So we have ran cameras and hunted on this property in the past, but it's been a couple years. So I took that intel and set cameras in the locations that we knew produced in the past to see if something was maybe the bucks that were there 2 years ago were still there, or mm-hmm. something new showed up. And then I had some curiosity spots I wanted to go to and just see what was out there. So my initial set was all about trying to cover as much of the property as possible mm-hmm. in locations that I think that the big bucks are using. You know, just knowing kind of what I know about the property and how the big bucks use it initially from historical data.
Right.
So I wanted to cover it as much as possible and just try to get eyes on something. Mm-hmm. So that was the initial set, was high traffic areas. There's a couple field edge cameras that we set that did produce. One of the field edge cameras did produce on that big nine. I got him multiple times on that camera middle of the night, but he was there. And it was in line with that cell camera that wasn't transmitting. So that was kind of exciting to see kind of what maybe what part of the ridge that he might be using the most.
Right.
And for the those cameras, I was hoping I was going to get daylight movement, but all I wanted was just to locate something and then go from there, whether it be middle of the night or middle of the day, whatever it be. And the cool part though is both that 10 point and that 9 point I got midday. So what I was would think when it comes to midday movement like that this early is we're really close to his main core area. Is that they're really not going to venture far this time of year. It's too hot, and they're going to stay pretty close to where they feel safe. So if I'm getting midday movement like that, I feel pretty confident that I'm really close to where I need to be. So that was a big tell. Both that 9 point and that 10 point were midday movement. And then so that was for us the second trip was all about adjusting to what we found. So knowing that we located a couple bucks, we accomplished that mission for the first set. Now it's time to take the cold cameras and move them to the hot areas. You know what I mean? So basically what I'm doing is I'm cluster setting on these bucks. I'm setting as many cameras as possible in high traffic areas, you know, creek crossings, ditch crossings, main points. If you've got some water sources, which every time I find these big buck beddings, we've got some kind of water source really close by, especially this early.
Right.
So, and then we're also, after we locate, we're like, okay, where's the main ag? Where's the north facing slope, you know, for the leeward side of the ridge for the wind, you know, how is he going to go about moving? If we can find his bedding, how's he going to go about moving out of that bed to crop fields in a most direct manner? So like they're still going to wander, but they're not going to wander nearly as much as they will in the fall.
Right.
So that was the kind of plan going into this weekend was like, okay, we need to find the cold cameras and take them out, move them. And especially since we got these bucks located, we cluster set on these two located bucks. And one of them, the 10 point, we actually found his bedding. That was a big find for us.
Yeah, for sure.
So since you found his bedding and kind of their main travel core area, you mentioned water sources. Since you're going to be hunting in September there in Kentucky, are you going to set up on a water source to try to catch him there, or what are you thinking on that?
Possibly, yes. So if I can, so with this 10 point, I'm going to use an example since we got him kind of pegged when it comes to bedding. He is bedding behind this pond, this pond bank. You got about 100 yards to some main ag fields to the north, and then you can go up the ridge to another main ag to the south. But he's right next to a pond bank. It's a bottom in this creek bottom, filled with stinging nettle and a lot of good browse in that bottom. And where this particular pond bank, there's some serious converging trails on it. So where we got the pictures of him was on a creek crossing, not 20 yards, probably from the edge of the pond, just down the pond bank a little bit. So we moved a camera up on top to see if we can maybe find some hidden movement on that pond bank. And it's very huntable with great access. It really would not be difficult for me to get in and set up on him on that pond bank. So if that's the case, then yes, I want to set up there. I'm trying to locate a spring in the hills for this big 9 point. I thought I had one located and we showed back up this time around, but it was after a really heavy rain. So it was hard to tell what was a spring and what was just standing water. So I feel good about what I found a month or so ago, but so I'm going to keep an eye on that. I do have a camera set close to it. So if I can find a little hidden water source like that up in the hills, then yeah, I'm going to be more likely to kind of sit on it or just sit super close to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like on the 10, you got the perfect scenario in place then.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the cool part about him is it seems like he's got a smaller core mm-hmm. range than the 9-point, which would make him more patternable and more huntable, basically.
Right.
Yeah, especially like where you're opening up on September 2nd down there.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're essentially going to be hunting the same strategy as you're setting your cameras, right? I mean, pretty close to it.
Yes.
Obviously, you have to take in wind and all that for where you're setting up, and you're already taking into account your access, I'm sure, being that you're hunting them so early. But essentially, that's what you're going to be doing because they should still be on those same patterns.
Yeah, they should be. So the only difference is there. I do want to be careful with my trail camera set, just because I don't want to bump them out mm-hmm. checking cameras. Mm-hmm. So I want to get as close as possible, figure out how close I can get without disturbing him and adding too much disturbance. So mm-hmm. my hunting strategy will be very, very similar to my trail camera placement for
right.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference is on the big 9-point, what we've got is coming out of the hills. We're trying to locate which point he's using predominantly. So we've got a few cameras set up on main ditch crossings down in the creek, down in the bottoms, right before he crosses over into the main ag field. And we set them up like we did just because we're trying to catch which ridge he's using more often.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can figure that out, then we can more than likely that just bounce up the ridge, and you can bet that he's bedding, you know, up towards that top third
right.
Of that ridge up on a bench up there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of make an educated guess on that if we can locate which point he's using more often.
Right. So let's kind of change the scenario a bit, and maybe you have something like this. If, say, you're getting this kind of activity on your trail cameras for a state that you're going to be hunting starting in October instead of the beginning of September. And maybe you do have some cameras out in like Kansas or some Missouri where you're going to be hunting in October. But how would your strategy change then? Because as you know, we all know that the patterns at some point in September generally change more to their fall patterns. They become a lot harder to find, and they're not going to necessarily be in the same places as you saw them over the summer, but you do still know they're there, and there's a possibility of them being in that area. So let's say you have this same situation, but instead of being able to hunt on September 2nd, now you got to wait till October 1st. How would that change things for you?
So when it comes to that scenario, more than likely I'm not hunting the same buck
mm-hmm.
because there's a good chance that buck is going to shift to a different location during his fall patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Normally what you're going to find is that a summer buck that you've got on property might not be the fall buck that you've got on property. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yep.
So what I'm going to take from that is I'm actually going to figure out how the herd in general uses the property. So where the main pinch points are, where the main funnels up in the hills and in the thicker stuff, you know, how the deer prefer to mm-hmm. use the property as a whole, as a herd in general, versus one specific buck. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely.
Because so if I could figure out, okay, well, a mature buck early season prefers to bed in this general area. Well, there's usually a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
So what's this going to look like possibly with a vegetation drop once mm-hmm. the leaves drop and the weeds kind of die off? what's this going to look like come fall? So they're not going to stay in the high stem count areas right now because mm-hmm. they're protecting their velvet. But where's a high stem count very close to where they're currently at?
Right.
You know what I mean? So that would be something that I would pay attention to. And you know, the pond is always going to be there and a spring is always going to be there. And that's always going to be valuable. Mm-hmm. And you know, where are the main mast trees at that point? You know, we're not hunting hard mast right now, but we will be come fall. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'll get these pictures and I'll see, okay, well, here's a main funnel that I'm getting a lot of pictures of, you know, decent bucks and does, and they feel comfortable here. Now, where's some high stem count and main hard mast, so oaks, mm-hmm. in that general area. And that's kind of how I'm going to use that information right now if I'm not going to hunt it until October.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And especially like what you're talking about, you're not looking for a specific deer's activity, but just kind of overall how they're using the property. And I think that translates a lot into private land too, not just public ground, especially that part of it. Because guys that maybe they want to run cameras on their property all year, they get excited about a buck that they're getting in July, and then they never see him in the season when maybe they shouldn't necessarily be paying attention to that buck, but how that buck and all the other deer they have on the property are using that property, and then that's information they can take into the fall.
100%.
When it comes mm-hmm. time to actually be in a tree and when their patterns have shifted.
100%. Because they're going to, you know, a buck can shift miles.
Oh, yeah.
From a summer range to a fall range. You know, he could be completely on a different property mm-hmm. and may venture over to his summer grounds at some point during the rut.
Yep.
But that's not going to be his core ground, mm-hmm. basically. So, if you can figure out kind of how they prefer to use that property, where they feel safe, you can take that information and put that into your fall patterns, because the does don't really matter about the high stem count,
right?
As the bucks do right now. Mm-hmm. So so the doe bedding really won't shift as much.
Right.
Where the buck bedding is, they're bedding in some weird spots because you got grown up grass and weeds and whatnot. Where then they're going to shift into the thicker, mm-hmm. nastier stuff, you know, once the leaves start falling and they become hard-horned.
Yep. I think that's, you made a good point there too, is where a lot of times bucks that you have in the summer, if you do see them again, it'll probably be during the rut because maybe they know there's does in that area. So if wherever their fall range is, either the does aren't in heat yet or they've ran out and he's cruising, going and looking for... going on an excursion like they generally do in the fall, a lot of times that will be back to their summer range. And I think there's a lot of research on that. But so that's even an equation where, like you're talking about with the doe movement staying the same, if you can find out where your does are moving, if you don't have any other bucks show up in the fall for whatever reason, but you know that one was there in the summer, or maybe you just you live out of state or something and you only have 2 weeks to hunt in November, maybe you key in on where the does have been using your property, hoping that that buck comes back to those areas where the does are using it.
And I'm going to throw a different scenario at you, too, with this property in particular. Because I didn't run cameras last year, but the 2 years prior to this, I ran cameras all year. So I got summer all through winter data. Mm-hmm. And what happened was the bucks that I was getting – on their summer patterns, you know, typically they disappeared, right, towards the end of September, but they returned towards the end of December.
Mm-hmm.
And I started getting them pictures on the same cameras that I was getting pictures of them during summer.
Right. Yep.
So there's a possibility. I mean, I'm not saying that this is a foolproof plan, but it's something that I did observe on this particular property that we're on, is that the bucks actually did, that particular buck did return to his quote unquote summer ground once the late season started to pick up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting, but you know, when he shifted out, another buck did shift in, you know, and typically it was maybe a bigger buck or, you know, more aggressive deer or whatnot. But that is something to maybe think about while you're running cameras during the summer, is maybe he can tip you off to some late season movement where if you've got a tag still in your pocket, maybe you go back to those summer routes and see if you can locate him again and then shift back into a little bit thicker cover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think, the value probably of the summer trail cameras. But really, when you're talking about places you can hunt in the fall, I don't think you can put enough emphasis on running your cameras, taking the data from year to year from your cameras that you run through the fall. Because those deer, a lot of times, and their fall range is going to stay the same, and their summer range is going to stay the same. So maybe your neighbor's getting the bucks that you're getting in the fall on his camera during the summer, but they're still coming back to you. So if you know where he was using your property the previous year and you weren't able to get on him, you can go back and use that more than you'll even be able to use the summer data. And then that, even running them through the late winter, I think what you're talking about there is you might find those deer that are coming back early, or some deer that are just moving in late, whatever it may be. You might have some pretty good information there as well.
Yeah, and you know, that is the cool thing is that I've typically found that throughout the entire year, there's a reason the deer are in a specific area on property. You know, like the bedding might shift a bit because of the vegetation change, but they prefer to stay in this part of the property because for some reason they feel more safe there than elsewhere.
And
Go
ahead.
I was saying just maybe this particular ridge doesn't get hunted as much historically. Mm-hmm. So that ridge could stay hot throughout the year. You just have to shift a little bit to find the daylight movement.
Right. And I think also in the fall, especially whenever you're getting closer to the rut, you have to take into consideration the human factor too.
100%.
You know, I hunt 25 acres that borders public ground, and the 25 acres I hunt is privately owned, but you got public ground right up against it. Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed, I can have all kinds of bucks in the summer on my cameras there. But then about the second week of October, they start disappearing.
Yep.
And then they completely disappear whenever you're talking after Halloween. And and then they might show back up again around after Christmas, you know. And I think whenever people start beating the bush and, you know, the public land hunters and stuff, there's a goose refuge about 2 miles from where I'm hunting that is forbidden for anybody to set foot on during that time period. And I think that that's where the bucks go, and the does also, because you just can't hardly find a deer there after the 1st of November.
Yeah.
What I was trying to say is you got to, and what you mentioned, you got to figure out where them deer feel safe at, you know, and that's where they're generally going to go. Like in my instance, I feel like that they feel safe. They've been around there and lived around there long enough, they know if they get to the goose refuge, well, then they've got it made for a month and a half.
100%. Yeah, that's we've observed that with a property we hunt here in Missouri. Is the property produces every year. I mean, it's got really great genetics, really great deer, but it gets hunted really hard. Mm-hmm. So by the time November rolls around, it's been hunted so hard that most of the deer have actually moved onto private land. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to find a core deer on property, you know, much less a mature buck that's staying on property other than a random move through during the rut. And, right. And that's just what you said, you know, in that instance, maybe you have an early hunt, you know, that's where your historical data run cameras is, okay, I've got till X weekend that these bucks feel comfortable on my property before typically they disappear. So that's where maybe you got to jump on them a little bit sooner, where like this property, if we wanted to find a more patternable deer on property, we got to jump on it as early as possible. So, before they really start getting pushed around, but yeah, no, 100% for fall. When it comes to fall patterns, I take more, stock in historical data, you know, cameras I ran last year than it was cameras that I'm running necessarily right now.
Right.
especially if it's a property I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. We're talking about pressure kind of a little bit there. How much are you expecting to see, and based on what you've seen in the past on this property, early September, how much pressure are you expecting down there in Kentucky?
It gets hunted hard.
Early?
Yes, early. Yeah. A lot of non-rut residents come in for that first couple weeks, you know, mm-hmm. hoping to get a velvet and whatnot. So we don't have any experience hunting it more into October. Mm-hmm. So we don't know how the hunting pressure is once it comes to that time. I bet it does shift a lot more to maybe more resident pressure versus non-resident.
Right.
But we don't personally have that intel. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, no, it gets hunted hard. And that's the interesting thing though, is that these deer have learned to survive. They figured out places they feel safe, and it's in the specific little spots. It's kind of right in between pressure and where they're coming from different, the pressure's coming from different directions. And for whatever reason, the deer hunters don't stay in this spot.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
So for whatever reason it may be, and that's in the deer know that, and they're like, all right, if I can hunker down, I can just watch him walk by. Mm-hmm. And if he gets a little close, I've got this route and this route of escape, and more than likely I'm going to be safe in that escape.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the interesting part though, is that it does get hunted really hard, and yet we're still, the bucks still feel safe enough to stay there
mm-hmm.
and be patternable.
So you're obviously looking for those areas where they feel safe enough to stay, but how much stock are you putting into their escape route? So if the pressure gets really high, are you ever looking to hunt maybe those areas you think they feel safe getting out of?
Sometimes, yes. I don't necessarily think too much about that for this September 2nd hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if it, you know, drags on and I haven't got a tag on a deer and I'm 2 weeks into season, then yeah, I'm going to take more stock into where he shifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Where he escaped. But because we're not dealing with a lot of walkers per se,
mm-hmm.
And the vegetation is really thick, I'm not taking as much stock into an escape route as I would be, say, opening day of rifle.
Right. Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that, yes, I take a lot of stock into when it comes to actual rifle season. I take a lot of stock into escape routes versus core patterns. Where right now I want bed to food.
Mm-hmm, right.
If I can find a good bed to food, consistent pattern for this guy, then that's what I'm going to hunt. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right. How often do you see, I heard a guy talk one time about hunting public ground, and he was talking about how he liked to hunt close to the private land that was around. And maybe if you had some private ground that wasn't getting hunted a lot next to the public, that's probably where the deer are going to go when they feel pressured. But
yeah,
how much do you think there's truth to being able to kill bucks like that? And then do you see a lot of guys doing that anyway? Because to me, that seems like something that would be not, I guess, kind of obvious, but also pretty popular strategy for people, because you just think when these bucks get pressured, where are they going to go? Well, they're going to go to the private ground. So
yeah.
Do you see that a lot? Do you see guys hunting like that a lot?
It does. It does get hunted like that quite a bit, especially with more and more people getting a little deeper
mm-hmm.
onto the properties. So they're still going to hunt middle. You know what I mean?
Right.
So if you're going to find a good spot that is close to private, usually it's a very, very, very small, weird spot.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found spots similar to that. And usually there's some kind of draw or, you know, edge between fields. You know, you got this finger of woods that connects private to public.
Mm-hmm.
Those are fantastic spots to hunt, but they do get hunted quite a bit.
Right.
So the spots that I found that actually produce like that are, like we just talked about, escape routes and just weird, overlooked, random spots. That it's right. very, very small area that he's actually on on public for a period of time. And I actually, last year, I about shot 170 on opening morning on an escape route, mm-hmm. on a spot close to private. But the way this ridgetop ran, he wasn't on public for a couple minutes tops. And he was on a side completely away from the public side. Mm-hmm. So if you weren't on this one spot, you would never have known that deer was ever there.
Right.
So it's really interesting, kind of those locations. I try not to hunt too close to private because, you know, I don't want a deer to run over to private.
Right.
And that, you know, you don't want to pressure luck there and get, you know, mm-hmm. Just not respect the boundary and whatnot. But, there are some spots that I found that there's a draw that leads out of the private bedding, and he's running the edge on the public side, mm-hmm. because there are mass trees there.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's that one's hit or miss, honestly. Mm-hmm. So, but a lot of guys do use that tactic.
Okay. I kind of figured they probably did, but, you know, I don't hunt a bunch of public ground, so I figured you would know based on what you've seen. How are your other states looking right now as far as cameras go? Have you done a lot camera-wise outside of Kentucky yet, card pulls or even still cams?
I haven't done any. So that, and the reason for that is because of the shift.
Like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. I find almost no value in running cameras and putting the effort into, mm-hmm. running cameras throughout the summer for a fall hunt.
Right.
I take more stock in my postseason scouting. I'll make the trips during my postseason, mm-hmm. and let them tell me via sign. And then I'll go in, say, late August or mid-September and run cameras. So that'll be my plan. You know, with Kentucky here, it's kind of all hands on deck trying to locate these bucks because they're not moving as far. Mm-hmm. And then I'll thin out those cameras or even completely pull them off of Kentucky and put them into, you know, places like Illinois. And, you know, I've got North Dakota coming up. Kansas is a little different this year because of the new law that went into effect, where last year I was, mm-hmm. able to run cameras.
Right.
So that'll be a little different. So I'll just kind of play it by ear when it comes to how I use my cameras from here on out. Mm-hmm. But I'll set them on those scrapes I found during my postseason scouting and those main ditch crossings and whatnot, if I'm able to actually run cameras.
Right.
So, that's kind of, I actually haven't even started setting cameras for fall hunts right now.
So, you're hunting all these states, obviously, and you don't want to waste any time. Which state are you going to be hunting in during the rut?
I'm kind of splitting my time. So Kansas, because it's closer and I'm a resident, mm-hmm. Kansas will be I'm taking my time on
right.
North Dakota, I'm going to go out for a late October hunt, mm-hmm. and I'm actually going to use the rut to my advantage, mm-hmm. for that hunt because I'm probably only going to get one trip. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And
increase your odds of getting lucky.
Exactly. Yeah. Increase my odds of getting lucky, increase my odds of finding fresh movement, mm-hmm. in the moment and setting up on it. You know, mm-hmm. what I mean? So I'm going to use the rut to my advantage there. And then Illinois opens October 1st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I may go up there for an October 1st hunt.
Yeah.
I'm not counting that out and hit that quote unquote October lull and then that pre-rut really hard. Mm-hmm. There before the hunting pressure dramatically picks up
right
towards the end of October. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, like with the rut, things happen really fast. Mm-hmm. So you could shoot a buck in one state, jump over and within a week shoot another.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're prepared in that state.
Yep.
That's why I do so much postseason scouting like I do. The only property I haven't done any scouting on is North Dakota because of the drive.
Right.
So that one will be in the moment where we're scouting on the fly and hunting as we scout, basically, you know, staying mobile and finding the fresh sign.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you this, if you can at all, try to get it done in Illinois before November, before the first weekend before Thanksgiving.
No, yes.
Because that weekend's when all hell breaks loose and the Orange Army comes out. And then after that, man, it's a crapshoot. And I can only imagine on public ground. But I know just on private, man, I got places that get hunted so hard around there that if I don't kill a buck before November 17th or 18th, whatever day it falls on, 19th, I'm pretty much chalking that one up as a loss because they're going to be ghosts after that.
And where I hunt next to that public ground, you know, you're talking after the first week of November, man, it just gets flooded with out-of-state hunters and everything. Yeah. And you might as well just go find somewhere else to hunt.
Right, right.
Or try to catch them headed to the goose refuge, the one or two.
No, and that's I'll use that pre-rut, and I'll hunt October hard. So I'm gonna spend time, and you know I'm gonna try to locate something in Kansas early if I can, because you've got a September 13th opener.
Yeah, yep.
If I can, that'd be fantastic. You know, and get it done early on a buck that's still kind of on pattern. But that's going to be an eyes on, just play it as it goes.
Right.
But I'll hunt October really hard and hopefully get a couple deer down during that time frame. And just make quick work of it as much as possible.
Well, you'll probably have one on the ground, say September 13th in Kansas, and you can, well, no, sorry, September 2nd or 3rd in Kentucky, hop over to Kansas. You'll have one killed on the 13th or 14th in Missouri. I mean, they open on the 15th, so you'll have that done by the 20th. You hop over to Illinois.
Well, my birthday is September 4th, so if he doesn't have the 10 pointer down by then, I give up on him.
Yeah.
Well, then, give up on me.
Yeah. Then October 1st or 2nd, you have one down in Illinois, and that gives you like a whole 2 months to hunt Nebraska. So, I'm not real sure what you're worried about.
Yeah.
I love the positivity.
Yeah, for sure. That would be a wild turn in your slam, is to do all opening days. You 2nd, 13th, 15th, 1st, and then Nebraska or North Dakota.
That would be insane. Yep. That would be like I'm getting accused of poaching. I can only imagine the comments.
Oh, gosh.
There'd be some eyebrows raised, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. I might have a game warden show up and say, hey, dude, what are you doing? I'm just hunting hard,
you
bro.
You can't be doing this legally.
Yeah, right? Actually, I am. Here's the camera footage. The camera footage.
Yep.
That's funny. Yeah. I love it.
Hey, that is honestly, though, in all seriousness, I can't even say the word seriousness, that is a plus, though, that Kansas, which you're pretty familiar with, and Missouri, both are early openers, with Kentucky, because that gives you 2 weeks where you're close. You can pop over to a place before Illinois even opens. And I don't know about Dakota. Is it October 1st opener as well?
No, North Dakota is actually a velvet state.
Okay.
I think it opens a couple of days before Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I chose Kentucky over North Dakota is because I have history with Kentucky.
Yeah.
That this velvet hunt is going to be significantly more difficult than a pre-rut hunt.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I would rather go to a property that I have some history with, knowing that it's going to be very difficult. So, that's why I chose Kentucky over North Dakota, even though North Dakota has a velvet hunt as well. Like you said too, is it's kind of set up where you could get a couple weeks worth of hunting in Kentucky, and then you've got Missouri and Kansas that you can spend some time in.
Yeah,
there before Illinois even opens, so you've got some time maybe to do some hunting, see how the deer are moving, and maybe even put one down, you know, before the lull really kicks in Illinois.
Yeah, you don't even have to worry about should I be in Illinois right now? Should I be? I should be over there hunting instead of over here. Like you said, you got a 2 week window there where you can't be in Illinois anyway.
Yeah.
So that gives you a pretty good. It's a little bit of peace of mind too. Just makes it a little easier to make decisions on where you should go.
It does, and my plan is to actually, you know, successful or not in Kentucky, is to take cameras and immediately jump up to Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and start running immediately in Illinois. It's not on the way at all,
right.
But at least starts getting intel, because if I can start gathering intel early, maybe I do have an October 1st hunt,
mm-hmm.
on a decent deer, you know, going into that hard mast and when they shift into those more fall ranges. My cameras are already there. Say I set cameras September 10th, just throwing out a number.
Mm-hmm.
But the buck I'm hunting may not show up till September 20th or
right.
25th. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But when he does, my camera's going to be there.
Right.
And there's my intel. So,
yep.
That's kind of my plan going into this, is pull cams off of Kentucky and shift them over to Illinois directly after the Kentucky hunt, successful or not.
Right. Yeah, and that's – I've seen it both ways where some deer, some bucks around here, or, you know, in Illinois or any state that opens on October 1st, I guess, will stay on their summer pattern into the first week of the season, just depending on the weather we're getting and the pressure they're getting. And then I've also seen them even on private ground where I watched a specific deer like the 28th, 29th, and 30th of September in the same place every evening. October 1st rolled around. I never saw the deer again.
Never saw him again, right?
He just vanished on the 30th. He was just gone. It just happened to be when he changed his range, you know. So, but he was one day off of being one of those deer that stayed in their summer range just barely too long. Some of them shift early, some of them shift late. So it's not to say you couldn't get a picture of one on September 10th that you end up killing on an opening day hunt if you get up there for one, you know what I mean?
100%. And you know, so I'm going to go back to this Kansas 10 point that I shot last year. I know we've talked about it, but mm-hmm. that was a cool thing, is he actually, I learned a lot from that deer, mm-hmm. is I started getting pictures of him around that September 10th time,
mm-hmm.
and he was working scrapes already, but he was all nighttime movement.
Mm-hmm.
And then he daylighted that first week of October.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really started collecting data on him, and he started becoming more regular.
Right.
I find that interesting that he was that early in September. I was getting pictures of him working scrapes, and he was still on, that was his rut. That was his core ground. I shot him middle of November.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very interesting actually, following that deer throughout the year, finding him as I did, and he was still there mid-November,
mm-hmm.
on a regular pattern.
He just started using it in daylight more, I guess, when the fall rolled around.
He did. He started using it in daylight more often versus being maybe down closer to the ag fields.
Mm-hmm. And some of that, I think, has to do, like, with their testosterone levels. And some deer, it raises earlier than others. So they have a higher testosterone level earlier in the year, so they start doing that more fall activity, I think, and it pushes them out. And that's kind of what breaks up the bachelor groups, among other things, you know.
Yeah.
So if mm-hmm. he's one of those deer that stays around out of that bachelor group, maybe that's a possibility, what was going on there too.
Yeah. And, you know, I never saw him running with any other deer.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it was because he was running with deer maybe closer to the ag fields, you know, with his bachelor
right.
group. And then at being the mature deer he was, maybe he broke off,
mm-hmm.
was touching his fall ground and was visiting his fall ground,
mm-hmm.
even though maybe he was using the bachelor group a little bit more often during that September time. You
mm-hmm.
know what I mean? That intel I don't have. So
right.
I can't answer that one for you, but that I can actually see that happen, because I never got pictures of him with a smaller deer like you typically see during this time with bachelor groups.
Right. He had it figured out, that those old bucks, he was on overtime. So he was hanging out with the boys in the daytime, and then he was going, getting ready for the ladies, getting a head start on the ladies at night, going and 100%. Working his scrapes. Yeah.
That was crazy. I hadn't found natural occurring scrapes that early before. Mm-hmm. These weren't mock scrapes. These were natural occurring scrapes. And there was multiple, there are clusters of them in this area that he ended up staying in all fall. And I ended up shooting him on that same ridge.
Mm-hmm.
So the scrapes shifted just a little bit, but they only shifted about 50 yards.
Right. Same general area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was interesting. And I will say a big, find for that was there's a spring 100 yards away.
Yeah.
So that was a big tell too. All the main movement, and especially that big mature movement, was over on that side closest to the spring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he had that preferred range set up already. You could tell he'd been there forever.
Yeah, no doubt. So you had one of your whitetail workshops, I believe it was last month, been a few weeks ago now, right?
Yes.
You were talking about it the last time you were in here. So how did everything go out there? I know we talked about it a little bit, but how'd everything go for the workshop? And did you have a good turnout and everything?
Yeah, it was fantastic. We had a great turnout. Everybody who came was super pumped to be there and came with questions. And that's what, you know, really fired me up too, is that's mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. You know what I mean? So, you know, I don't like running workshops in a lecture style of,
right,
of teaching. That's just not how I like to do things and whatnot. You know, I'd rather answer questions about your personal experiences, what you want to know, mm-hmm. you know, in the moment. And then I can answer that maybe from things that I've experienced and deer that I've shot in the past with similar circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we introduced, you know, quite a few guys to saddle hunting for the first time, never sat in a saddle. And few guys came that already been saddle hunting for a while, but wanted a few tips, want to learn a couple things. So it was a lot of fun collaborating with everybody and answering questions and really seeing kind of like a light bulb go off where, you know, they were chasing a buck for a couple of years but haven't been able to make it happen and seal the deal. And then you're mm-hmm. like, well, what do you think about this?
Right.
And there's a spot like that close by. So I'm like, oh, maybe look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe try, that'd be something to look into, you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great turnout. Everybody had a blast. It was hot, obviously, but man, it was a good time. We had a good time.
That's good.
It was 6-hour day, man. It was a full day of talking nothing but deer.
Hey, that's awesome. Were these mostly guys that have been hunting a while? Was it some younger hunters as far as like in their hunting career, not necessarily younger in age, but or was it a mix? What'd you see as far as that goes?
It was a little bit of a mix. We had probably half of the hunters that there were either brand new or only been hunting a couple years, mm-hmm. a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the rest of the group. They've been hunting for a while, but they haven't really tried pursuing more mature deer,
right.
And they were wanting to start diving into that and start learning more how to harvest the more mature bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And also that's kind of where it is, more very beginner on into a little bit more novice intermediate deer hunter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a really good mix, and that's what made it for a great actual conversation and whatnot.
Yeah. And you got another one coming up soon, the 29th, I believe, which is Deer Hunting Extravaganza and Whitetail Workshop. So it's going to be a similar event, I take it?
Yeah, and that one's going to be a very similar event and a little bit different. This last workshop and most of my workshops are going to be a longer day and just a small crowd, right? And we're just going to spend a lot of time talking and getting in the saddle, mm-hmm. and walking property and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a little bit more similar to an expo. We're going to have some vendors, mm-hmm. and we got multiple speakers, including myself, that are going to put on presentations.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of that day, we won't spend as long of a workshop, but we'll do about half the time for a workshop for whoever else is interested in actually getting a little bit more in-person learning, a smaller group learning, where it's not just me up there doing a presentation. You actually have questions and things you want to know. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to, and same thing with a saddle, I'll always have saddles there and teach mobile hunting and whatnot. So it'll be very, very, very similar to the, to my normal workshops, but a little bit shorter. Okay. So it's going to be kind of a fun deal. We've got, you know, mineral guys showing up, seed companies. They're going to be talking about, you know, fall food plots. Mm-hmm. I think we've got some taxidermists coming, mm-hmm. and an outfitter and whatnot, and maybe a presentation for tracking dogs. And a guy real knowledgeable with using his dog for blood trailing and, mm-hmm. and what. So it's going to be a fun event and a little bit different than my typical whitetail workshop. Mm-hmm. But at the end of that, we will have a normal workshop setting out there. We'll have some saddles and a little bit smaller group setting. So that one's going to be fun. We're pretty pumped about getting that completely organized, and we're working hard right now on spreading the word.
Mm-hmm. So, that one's going to be in Missouri, right?
Yeah, that'll be Higginsville, Missouri.
Higginsville, Missouri. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I will link that. I'll put a link to that in the description of the episode as well. So anybody listening that is interested in that, whether you be from that area or outside of that area, you'll be able to find it really easy in the description. But whether we link that to your Facebook page or whatever it is, we'll make sure that they can find that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I've got an event set up on my Facebook page that you can see all the details. And also my website has all the details on it as well. You can pop on over to either of those, and you can see all the details and get your ticket bought.
Cool, man. I'll definitely link that in the description so they can find it, because I think that's a really good opportunity. Listening to a podcast is great, but like I've done it before, I'll be listening to something and you'll think, well, what about this? And then it doesn't really get covered, and then you forget about it later. Like if you have a chance to go back and leave a comment or something, or on a Facebook group like what we've got, you kind of forget about it. Whereas if you're live in person doing that and they got a question, it's just bam, right there. You can answer it and address it. And that leads to other questions. I think it's a really good forum, and I'd really like to see more of it. More guys that would be doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, I personally love the setting of those workshops, because you learn from everybody's different experiences. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got this question pops up over here, and another guy's like, man, I never even thought about that. That's a great idea. Right. Or, you know, you get to thinking about your particular property that you hunt or some deer you've chased in the past. You're like, oh, okay, well maybe if I did this instead of this, it would have been a more successful hunt. So I love that setting. You know, like you said, the podcasts are awesome and YouTube videos are awesome, mm-hmm. but you don't get that in-person conversation.
Right. Very limited interaction.
It is. And you know, they're fantastic, but each scenario is individual. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, when I get, you know, a comment or even a message, usually I follow up the question with multiple other questions to figure out the scenario.
Right.
Each scenario is a little bit different, and your tactics leading into those will be different. Mm-hmm. So that is something that I love about that workshop setting, is you can get more in detail with your interaction and asking questions, mm-hmm. and really dive in deep in what's going on with that specific question.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I know we've done this before, and again, go back and listen to the other episodes we've had Austin on. We've talked about some different things, and again, got his background on the first one we did. But go ahead and tell everybody, and I'll link this stuff too, but tell them where they can find you and Tactical Approach Outdoors.
You can find me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok at Tactical Approach Outdoors, and my website is tacticalapproachoutdoors.com. Got a lot of information I like to keep steady on my YouTube channel, mm-hmm. and also something new I'm firing up. Our first whitetail webinar is July 17th.
Sweet.
And that's on my Patreon page. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole new setup I have with Deer Hunter Academy. I'm going to put some different educational videos on there that you won't see on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing is having those live Q&A webinars, which that's as close to the workshop setting as you can get.
Right.
With actually going to a workshop. So you know, you've got basically it's like a podcast here, but it's an interactive Zoom call, basically. Interactive podcast. Mm-hmm. So those are a whole lot of fun, and they'll be great going through season because, you know, hey, if you got a couple questions in the moment, you got a buck on property and you're trying to figure out how to put them down, but you need to kind of know that information now, jump on that webinar, and you know, your experience, you know, may lead to somebody else's success as well as yours.
Yeah, no doubt.
So
no doubt. So, Jeff, you got anything else for the man?
Nope.
All right. Hey, we're getting excited about the season. It's coming up here in another, well, yours is coming sooner than ours. So I know you're pumped and ready for it, especially after what you saw, what you found this past weekend. So we'll definitely keep up with you on here. We'll have you on again sometime, if not before you go down there to Kentucky, sometime around that time. We'd love to get you back in studio as well. But then I've been enjoying keeping up with the Whitetail Slam episodes on YouTube as well. So keep those coming.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm going to keep those coming, and it's only going to get better this last half of the year.
That's right. That's right. We're getting down to the nitty-gritty of it. We're almost to that time. Yep, almost to go time. So, hey, man, again, appreciate you coming on. We'll have you back for sure. Always one of our favorites to talk to. But we'll catch you again sometime soon.
Sounds great. I appreciate you having me on.